This is Stateside. I'm Lester Graham. Sure. There are many histories of Detroit. The latest is a comprehensive look at the contributions, accomplishments, and long-suffering of the African-American populations who've called Detroit home. The book is Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. The author is Herb Boyd, and he joins me in the studios of our Detroit Journalism Cooperative partner, WDET. You cover abolitionists, soldiers, merchants, leaders, black nationalists, the list goes on. Let's start at the beginning, though. Since it's a northern city, not everyone realizes that early Detroit included a lot of slaves, some of them Native Americans, some of them African Americans. How common was slavery in Detroit?
Well, one of the things about this, and a number of books kind of misconstrued the whole question or issue of slavery in the so-called Northwest, the Northwest Ordinance of 1787, which, of course, outlawed slavery in the territory. But, of course, you always have a difference between what they call de jure and de facto.
Right.
There was a whole lot of slaveholders here in the city of Detroit. During this research, Lester, I thought I had Detroit's history pretty cold, particularly from a black perspective, how wrong I was. And, of course, the whole slavery issue, looking at the abolitionist period, it was just so fruitful in terms of getting an understanding of the very beginning of African people, African-American people in the city.
Well, let's talk about that because, I mean, with its proximity to Canada, Detroit was the last stop on the Underground Railroad. What role did the Detroit black community play in abolitionism?
One of the individuals that I focus on here is William Lambert, along with George D. Baptiste. They were pretty much the pioneers. They were the chief conductors of the Underground Railroad. Detroit is like the terminus. You make it to Detroit, you figure that you have a refuge, a sanctuary, and you escape bondage. But the bounty hunters were always on the trail. And I talk about the Blackburn affair. This is Thornton and Lucy Blackburn, who arrived in Detroit in the 1830s from Louisville, Kentucky. And
escaped.
Yeah, exactly. They're fugitives, and they arrive here after they're abducted or grabbed off by these bounty hunters. And the Detroit residents, you know, at that time say, no way in the world we're going to let you keep them and take them back into bondage. And so therein ensues, you know, a lot of conflict. Ultimately, they get across the Detroit River, they get off to Windsor, and ultimately end up in Toronto, Canada, many, many years later.
But there are racial problems after that because
Doubt. I mean, because, see, a sheriff is killed as a result of this. So that means there's the trials and the outrage in the community. So this is really Detroit's first riot in 1833.
Let's jump ahead a few decades to the Civil War. A lot of European immigrants were angry about conscription into the military service. What was their attitude and how did that affect African Americans in Detroit?
Mostly hostility between the African-American community and the Irish community. Usually when you have those issues is around housing and jobs. And, of course, jobs is critical in this situation because many of the white workers figure that, why should I be going off and losing my job? As soon as I leave my job, a black person come in and take it. So there was some concern, some discontent about the whole involvement, you know, of white workers, you know, in this here war that creates some tension in the community.
There was already tension because these were fairly new immigrants, a lot of them, and they were being conscripted to fight in a war to help free black people while they watched a black person take their job when they leave. So that adds to that whole tension.
It adds to the conflict, no doubt.
Let's go to the 20th century. Detroit became a city of opportunity for a lot of workers. Work was referred to in one song as going to work at Mr. Ford's place. It was attractive. Tell us about that migration from the South to Detroit.
This is the first, the so-called Great Migration of the 1920s, and it was spurred by an offer coming from Henry Ford, $5 a day. Can you imagine that? It was an astronomical amount of money at that time, particularly for sharecroppers, people so recently emancipated from slavery. So you had this huge influx, you know, coming from Mississippi, Georgia, and particularly from Alabama. These sharecroppers down south, the black sharecroppers, seeing this possibility to get beyond the cotton curtain to get to the so-called promised land. And so this offer spurred a whole lot of activity in this country and gave Detroit this year kind of quadrupled the black population in the city of Detroit. But it created what you call social welfare problems, too, in terms of housing and the so-called jobs that was offered. Some of that was illusion. Mm-hmm.
Right. And then we saw further migration during World War II, both black and whites from the South. With that migration, Southern attitudes were further carried into the city. That brings us to 1943. Mm. There was a race riot. What sparked that?
Well, one of the things, now we have like a very strong black population in the city, and many of them come as a result of the second migration. My mother was a part of that one, 1941-43, when she arrived in the city. I arrived in Detroit a couple of months before the 43 riot. That was kind of like my introduction to Detroit, more or less, when I was 4 years of age. And when that was spurred, first of all, it was a rumor. There was a certain kind of a bubbling tension and intensity in the community between the various groups anyway, which you might call the ingredients for an explosion there. All you needed was a fuse and then the spark. And a rumor sparked that, and the next thing you know, boom, 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 the two communities are at each other's throats. We lost quite a few people, you know, at that time. The housing, the property damage, you know, was very extensive. That's the kind of like the follow-up. You're looking at 1833, 1863, now you got to 1943, and you have some of the same problems, you know, that created this turmoil.
While the city's had these race-based clashes every generation or so, it's also been a city of opportunity for black citizens. They might not have been able to get the job that they'd hoped for when they got here, but that caused them to create their own businesses, and a lot of them became very successful. So who stands out to you in that?
That's a story I try to tell in there that's not often told in terms of the black elite, the black entrepreneurs, the black middle class, because ultimately that's going to be the mother's milk, you know, of the city of Detroit in terms of stabilizing and the foundation. You got these African-American, the aspirations, you know, the ingenuity, the genius, you know, the even like Elijah McCoy, you know, in terms of the innovations and the inventors coming in that would add to this here kind of industrialization that's taking place in the city of Detroit. So black workers are at the point of production, but at the same time, they're connected to these black entrepreneurs. In fact, the restricted covenants at that time, you know, Lester, kept us confined in such a way that you could have like the young man who was running a shoeshine parlor is living right next door to a lawyer and to a doctor. So they're kind of like this here mutual sharing, you know, in terms of their conditions, both the white supremacy, the racism, the segregation. In other words, there was some kind of benefits coming from segregation in terms of the various classes being melded together like that.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Elijah McCoy. I thought it was really interesting. He had so many patents that to make sure that you understood that that was one of Elijah McCoy's patent, they came up with the phrase, the real McCoy.
Right.
I was surprised to learn that.
Kind of symbolizing that, yes.
As you know, the 50th anniversary of the 1967 uprising has meant a lot of coverage of that moment. How did you deal with it in your book, Black Detroit?
You have to put it in historical and political context. It's not in a vacuum. It's like 1943, there were some precursors, things that led up to it. We had similar circumstances in 1967, the whole Kershaval situation on the east side in 1966.
Remind us what that was.
Exactly. The northern school, Eastern High School, the walkouts of young people who were concerned about their education in the city. So you had the educational problems, you had housing problems, and you certainly had employment situation, to say nothing of police brutality. So you mix all those things together, you know, you have a recipe for disaster, and that's essentially what happened with 67.
The arts, culture, and activism of African Americans in Detroit is important in your book. Often they intermingle. You had a firsthand look at a lot of that part of Detroit. How did you decide what to put into the book?
Oh, Lester, what a decision that is, because you have so much to choose from. Of course, when people talk about Detroit, the first two things out of their mouths and their understanding is Motown, and after that is the automobile industry. But of course, what you discover in Black Detroit that is much deeper than that. At one time in the 1960s, Lester, you could not talk about a quartet, a quintet, a trio, or ensemble, or orchestra, or big band that did not have an African-American musician in it. But that goes back to the 1880s, 1890s, Theodore Sweeney, and we going right on down to McKinney's cotton pickers in the 1920s, to say nothing of this here real explosion in the 1960s, both on rock and roll, rhythm and blues, John Lee Hooker. Detroit had that reputation. And of course, that was a long-standing reputation that continues even today. I was moving around with all this here celebration about our anniversary of the 67 Rebellion, that various institutions that are involved, the Detroit Institute of Arts, the Historical Society, the Charles Wright Museum, the whole Concert of Colors that recently occurred, all of these have given us an opportunity to see again how the Detroit's musical tradition and legacy is just as alive and well as it always has been.
I want to ask you about what's being called Detroit's latest renaissance. The politicians and promoters like to call it the comeback city, but in many of the neighborhoods where I spend the bulk of my time reporting, the recovery is not really having much of an impact. Based on what you learned writing this book, what do you think the trajectory of the city and its residents is?
For me, whenever I look at a city or even a civilization, my first concern is the treatment, the condition of the children, condition of the women. What we see here in Detroit is like almost like a tale of two cities. And the whole question of gentrification, I don't know how much of that is a concern here in Detroit, because
it's becoming a greater one.
It's becoming a more and more of a concern. But one of the things about this is that the kind of concentration of capital and the concentration of investment and housing and building, it has to be a little bit more extensive than just downtown Midtown. And until it reaches out into the 138 square miles of the city of Detroit, where it begins to impact some of the neighborhoods that I grew up in, I can see where there's like either vast empty lots or dilapidated buildings, the water is cut off. These are kind of ongoing concerns that many of the neighborhoods have. And so I would love to see a little bit more of emphasis and impetus. You know, it seemed to be flourishing downtown. I mean, it gives you kind of the illusion that Detroit is doing quite well. We had that kind of illusion in 1967, didn't we?
Herb Boyd is the author of Black Detroit, A People's History of Self-Determination. He's a son of Detroit who currently teaches African-American history and culture at the City College of New York in Harlem, where he lives. Thanks very much.
Always, Lester. Thank you.
Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative on Michigan Radio comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, Renaissance Journalism's Michigan Reporting Initiative, the Ford Foundation, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.